We're broadcasting from Washington, D.C., the city where they send troops to war and decide on your tax rate. So there is a lot of drama to go along with all that soul-killing politics. One author has mined Washington's secrets for 17 best-selling crime novels. The nation's capital is the setting for our next story in our summer reading series, Crime in the City. Here's NPR's Ari Shapiro.
There are eyes everywhere. We're being watched, even in our car.
Turn right on Lee Highway.
We're following GPS directions to an unmarked office just outside of Washington, D.C. The man we're about to meet is behind dozens of high-level government conspiracies. They involve the CIA, the FBI, even the president. We pull into an anonymous-looking office park just over the D.C. border in Virginia. An unmarked Homeland Security building is next door. The guys who run America's spy satellites, they're just across the street. And the man we're here to see is not even listed on his building's directory.
It's all very clandestine, you know. I am what I write about.
That's him, David Baldacci. If you've been to an airport bookstore in the last 10 years, you've seen him, staring out from the book jacket of his Camel Club mystery series or the Sean King and Michelle Maxwell novels. His latest is called First Family. Washington, D.C. is Baldacci's hunting ground.
The city is full of the most intense people you will ever find in your life. And they live, breathe, drink, eat, sleep this stuff 24/7.
There's a reason Washington is so intense, and so are Baldacci's novels. The stakes here could not be higher. Many of his books could be set nowhere else.
I'm not talking about, you know, a typical crime novel where a gumshoe detective is trying to solve a murder. In a thriller like this, you know, a city disappears, or war is declared, or 1,000 people die.
Now, Baldacci's going to take us spy hunting. 5 minutes away, Baldacci points out Michelle Maxwell's apartment. She's a troubled former Secret Service agent and the heroine in some of Baldacci's novels. Maxwell is fictional, but her apartment is real. It's a totally nondescript complex. Baldacci calls it bland by design.
You're describing this apartment complex as a place where spies could plausibly live. Given how close we are to CIA headquarters, they probably do.
Oh, absolutely they do. A lot of these places are long-term rentals. A foreign government can rent this place out for a year, 2 years, 3 years. They could have different agents coming in and out, living here. You know, you don't want to be right across from the street from the White House. That's where people are watching. Here, there's nobody watching. So they come and they go. They're normal lives. They look like just everybody else.
And they go places everyone else goes. The grocery store, the movie theater. Around here, even the most mundane places have been centers of international espionage.
I live in an area that has a park where my son played Little League baseball. And everybody in the area sort of calls it the spy park because there have been more spies caught there dropping off stuff. Even my son, my son was 9 years old. He says, Dad, it's the spy park. Everybody knows that. Why don't they go someplace else?
So I have an important question for you. Do you think we're being watched?
The odds are very good that we're probably being watched.
It's just me, or is there a pair of binoculars peeking out from behind some of those window blinds?
So long as it's not a sniper rifle, I'm okay.
We drive into the city, right to the global center of power, the White House.
That's the site of assassination attempt on Truman's life. Two Puerto Rican nationalists are coming in from either side, trying to assassinate the president.
We're surrounded by tourists, business people, government staffers. They all look about as non-threatening as you can get. Baldacci says that's what spies want you to think.
Which of these people do you think would be most likely to be engaged in some kind of nefarious plot?
There's a guy over there in a white and green check shirt. He's an elderly guy. He's looking at the White House. He's taking pictures. He's having a great time. He's going to go back and tell his grandkids what a wonderful thing I did. But he might be taking pictures as a way of signaling somebody inside those grounds that actually works there. It's been a plant from a cell that's been there for 20 years. And based on that information, something is going to happen later on.
Suddenly, there's action behind us.
Is that the president?
No, the motorcade is not big enough for the president, but it's somebody serious because they have at least one SUV full of Secret Service agents.
Cabinet member, vice president?
Could be. It could be the vice president. Yeah, because the limo we saw go by was a Beast-style limo. It was not your ordinary limo.
The Beast, by the way, is the code name for the president's armored car.
The Beast windows are phone book thick, and they don't roll down. The president can't roll them down and say, hey.
Is there something personally satisfying and fun about
getting so close to the center of power, getting into the beast with the president in your novels?
Oh, there's a head rush, undoubtedly, because, you know, 99.9% of the people never get a chance to do that. But they want to know what it would be like, and I allow them to sort of know what it would be like.
Baldacci points to our next stop, just across the park.
It's actually probably the closest church to the White House. I believe it's the one on Easter. This is where the Obamas went.
We walk into St. John's Episcopal Church. Every president since James Madison has attended services in this modest yellow building. In Baldacci's novel, First Family, the First Lady sneaks out of the White House for a clandestine meeting here. Turns out, real First Ladies have done the same thing.
We've had visits from the First Lady like that, where it was unannounced. And, we had one from Laura Bush on Good Friday a couple years ago.
Hayden Bryan is the church's operations director. He says, in Washington, D.C., even a house of God can be a den of spies.
We use a walkie-talkie system here sometimes. I've actually picked up people being followed on the walkie-talkie, just bleeding over into our channel.
In what context?
I don't know. But you hear people saying, he's getting up, he's taking the briefcase with him, he's walking down the street.
It really is the heart of spy land.
I mean, the CIA used to use our front bench out here as a drop.
How did they use it?
I don't know. They just, you know, they would leave something taped to the underside or whatever and put a little mark, X or something, indicating they'd made the drop. You know, it was a training.
A man approaches Baldacci from between the pews, and suddenly it becomes clear why he likes to keep a low profile.
Oh, I just finished your last book. Then my God in heaven, you're wonderful. I just said the way you brought it all in, and poor little Gabriel and Ruth.
Even in the church, there is no sanctuary. Eyes are everywhere. Baldacci's cover is blown. Our mission is compromised. It's time to get out of here. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Film critic Nathan Rabin has written a very funny book about his not very funny life. We're talking family breakdown, teenage truancy, an inept suicide attempt, a stint in a mental hospital, 5 years in a foster care group home, some sexual misadventures and mind-numbing jobs. He got his start in the film business working as a clerk at Blockbuster. His story is about staying sane by connecting with pop culture and surviving to the ripe old age of 33. To be, as he is now, head writer of the AV Club, which is the entertainment section of The Onion. His book is called The Big Rewind, and he joins us from Chicago. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This is, by the way, this is a story about your life, a memoir, so I should ask you the question that arises from any number of scandalous memoirs of recent years. How true is it?
It is absolutely true. I actually just had dinner with my sister and some book world people, and my sister marveled at how unexaggerated it was. She said our family has a unfortunate tendency towards stretching the truth, but that I was uncharacteristically honest in my depiction of myself and the world around me.
I want you to explain the relationship between the songs or the movies that you write about in each chapter, a little bit of criticism, and the episode in your life that they connect to. What's the structure here?
Well, the structure is that I basically take an episode or an era or a period in my life. I'm getting a little crazy with the synonyms there. And I find a book or a song or an album or a movie that I kind of use as a springboard, a filter to discuss it and how it kind of helped me understand the experience or was intricately linked to the experience. I tried to have a very eclectic group of pop culture touchdowns, and I feel like that's very endemic to my generation, sort of the generation of Quentin Tarantino and The Simpsons.
Well, one of the books that you write about, and this is in the chapter, it's very a very understandable connection, it's in the chapter about your time at a mental hospital when you were a kid, is Susanna Kaysen's book, Girl Interrupted, and then the movie with Winona Ryder that was made about it. The book was very meaningful to you.
Oh, very much so. I kind of felt like she had the same experience that I did, which is very strange because there were decades removing it, and she was in very upper middle class and went to one of the best mental hospitals in the world. And I went to one, yeah, that basically existed to make money, and it was kind of soul-crushing and dispiriting. But there was a sense of just this overwhelming emptiness and this idea that people were there because they'd entered this kind of strange purgatory where kind of no life or joy or hope could possibly. It was kind of a black hole, an emotional black hole.
Yeah, I wonder if you could read from a passage in the book when you write about Kaysen's book and then the movie that was made of it.
Oh, sure. I would be happy to. The whole point of Kaysen's book is that her 18 months in the mental hospital are a season in purgatory. There is no redemptive arc, no life lessons to be learned, no glorious epiphanies. But in the film version, Kaysen's character learns valuable life lessons, engages in hardcore bonding with her peers, and ends the film older, wiser, and ready to face the challenges of life outside. With intelligence, taste, and only the best of intentions, writer-director James Mangold transformed a book that told the truth into just another Hollywood lie. When I interviewed Mangold, I asked him why he blunted the book's political message and feminist subtext. He told me that movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest had already covered that territory.
It's a passage that suggests being a film critic and talking about Hollywood movies must be a perennially disappointing experience.
Well, there's a passage in my book where I say, to be a film critic is to exist in a state of perpetual disappointment. Mm-hmm. Because every time the light goes down, you live in hope. And you want a movie to be good. And you want to be surprised. And you want to be entertained. And more often than not, that is not the case. But it is also to live in perpetual expectation and perpetual hope. So it's kind of this violent conflict that goes on inside every time you see a movie.
Your story, the story of your book, it's very funny. It's very profane. It's also very dark, very dark. Do you ever expect to find film that connects with adolescent dread and anomie as it really is, or depression, or hospitalization in a psychiatric institution?
Well, I think the piece of art that probably captures that the most is Catcher in the Rye, and it is perhaps not coincidental that that has never been turned into a movie and probably never will be turned into a movie, and many, many people wanted to. Jerry Lewis actually at one point really, really wanted to turn Catcher in the Rye into a movie. But did not. And I feel like it's an emotional train that is foreign to most adults. It's something that they forget. It's like there's an impossible gulf between when you're an adolescent and you see the world a certain way, and then when you become an adult, you can recapture it a little bit, but it's very, very hard to recapture whole. And I think that's one of the things that Catcher in the Rye did and why that means so much to so many people.
Do you remember the two pieces of advice that your girlfriend's mother gave you?
I do indeed. Their number one is lower your expectations. Number two is a settle.
Settle.
Yeah, I've followed that advice throughout my life.
Right now, you're writing for a very hip publication and a website, The Onion, and you've already had your cable TV show.
Yeah, my poorly rated, mildly disreputable basic cable movie review panel show, as I insist it always be referred to.
This was with John Ridley.
Yes.
And now you have your memoir out at 33. You feel you've emerged?
What took me so long?
What took you so long? Where you been?
Exactly. Yeah.
You feel that you've emerged from this dark adolescence, which featured, among other things, no mother, your father experiencing terrible illness and complete fall from social and economic position?
Well, I don't trust happiness or contentment. I'm sort of a lifelong depressive. And I feel like my book, sort of the dark secret of it, is that it's secretly a serious book about depression. Sort of nestled within this very kind of insane, profane, dark comedy. I grew up, I always felt like I had kind of this Great Depression mindset where I always thought that the bottom would drop out and that everything was going to disappear tomorrow. And it's taken me a really, really long time to get over that. But I've been with The Onion for 12 years. I'm really proud of this book. So I'm beginning to experience an emotion I believe you humans know as happiness and hope and optimism. And I know that all of those things will come back to bite me and will come back to destroy me in the end. But I'm trying to savor the moment. And I feel like I owe it to, you know, the 14-year-old me that just hated the world and was like a sentient ball of rage to appreciate the fact that this book is being perceived and received the way I wanted it to, and that a lot of people who've struggled with depression, mental illness, have come up to me and said they really, really appreciated somebody writing about it and kind of destigmatizing it. And I feel like one of the things that makes depression so agonizing is that you feel like you're the only person in the history of time who ever went through these things. Mm-hmm. So to have a book about somebody who went through these things and maybe worse, and yet seemed to have come out with a sense of humor and a sense of perspective, I think is a powerful, powerful thing.
Well, Nathan Rabin, thank you very much for talking with us today.
No, thanks for having me.
Nathan Rabin's book is called The Big Rewind, a memoir brought to you by Pop Culture.
The historic decrease in crime on the island of Manhattan has forced a New York City crime writer to adjust. Gabriel Cohen keeps his fictional detective across the East River in Brooklyn.
So much of the life of Manhattan is kind of hidden up at the top of these buildings, whereas in Brooklyn, the life is pretty much out on the street, out on the stoop, out on the waterfront.
The perfect place for a writer who wants to explore neighborhood and history through the eyes of a cop. As part of our Crime in the City series, Gabriel Cohen showed NPR's Robert Smith where the bodies wash up.
We're heading out to Brooklyn the way Gabriel Cohen's detective might, by boat, and slightly nauseous.
I get seasick just thinking about getting seasick.
Luckily, it's a smooth day on the water as we swing into Buttermilk Channel, and the Brooklyn waterfront opens up in front of us. This is the neighborhood known as Red Hook.
I think a lot of New Yorkers don't really know much about this kind of strange, low, flat waterfront neighborhood with these old Civil War era warehouses.
This place was a mystery to Cohen when he first started to explore it about a decade ago. Red Hook used to be this thriving New York port, and then all of a sudden it became a ghost town. The fate of Red Hook was Cohen's original whodunit.
What happened to it? How could it possibly have been so busy and then now be so quiet? I chose this character who was sort of in the thick of all that enabled me to explore it.
NYPD Detective Jack Leitner grew up in Red Hook in its heyday. Now, only murder brings him back. The ferry stops on the Red Hook waterfront right at a brand new IKEA store built on what used to be a ship repair facility. But we're going to head down one of these empty cobblestone streets and tackle what we're calling the case of the missing neighborhood. In Cohen's series, Leitner's family lives the history of Red Hook. The detective's father was a Russian immigrant, a dock worker here. The detective's son is a young filmmaker who lives in the hip neighborhood to the north. And Jack, well, like Red Hook itself, he's complex.
I think he has a little bit of an outsider's perspective. He's Jewish, for one thing, and I think the percentage of Jewish cops in the NYPD is something like 5%.
And to use the Yiddish term, he's a little bit of a schlub.
That sounds too harsh. I love the guy. I find things to admire in him. I wouldn't call him a schlub or a loser because he has a real passion and commitment for what he's doing.
On some of these streets, it's hard to spot any sign of life, but here on Conover, there's a sign with three letters, B-A-R.
That's Sonny's Bar, and we're about to meet Sonny.
This is an old dock worker's bar, and it's built a little bit like the inside of a ship. Sonny Balzano's family has run this place for three generations. If we're going to investigate the death of Red Hook, Sonny is the first eyewitness.
In those years when I was growing up, it looked like the Long Island Expressway out there in the river. This was one of maybe 40 bars in the whole neighborhood.
40 bars?
Yeah, this is like the only one left of the bars from that era.
Back in the old days, with all the money and longshoremen in this neighborhood, crime was a fact of life. Sonny remembers one murder just outside the bar.
It was a vendetta on the Iceman. I heard this cracking about 5, 6 o'clock in the morning. And I looked out the window and there was his body, you know, just... I used Mac the knife. He was oozing blood, you know.
But that was a long time ago. Sonny left the neighborhood when he was a young man. And when he came back, the crowds, the pork, the bars were all gone. So who would have the motive to kill a neighborhood like this? Cohen takes me down by the water.
We're looking across the harbor now. If you look to New Jersey, you see this sort of thicket of these loading cranes from the ships. A lot of that shipping and unloading moved to New Jersey because it's much easier to have access to railroad yards there. And that just devastated this neighborhood.
Okay, so New Jersey is a likely suspect, as are container ships that made these old piers obsolete. The problem was, with no eyes on the neighborhood, it became the perfect place to dump a body.
Can I read you a quote?
Sure.
from one of the books?
This is from your novel, The Graving Dock.
When the water warmed up, bacteria released gases in the corpses, and they rose to the surface, usually around mid-April. It was known as Floater Week. There was a strange poetry to it, all those cold, submerged bodies rising up. The drunken boaters, the bridge jumpers, the victims of mob hits, who often escaped their concrete shoes or chains as their bodies softened and frayed.
Oh, that is not what the two guys fishing next to us want to hear. Although they say they have pulled up just about everything you can think of from these waters.
Condoms, empty containers, bottles, stuff like that.
Some people call the condoms Coney Island whitefish.
Ever pull up a dead body?
If I did, I'll cut the string and let him go again.
Al Torres grew up here in Red Hook, in the housing projects during the deserted 1980s. He says if anyone's responsible for the death of the neighborhood, it's all the new development springing up in just about every empty lot and warehouse. That brought in more cops, he says, more people watching him.
Cameras, they put up cameras, surveillance. I miss it when it ain't had none of that.
Well, you know, that's what happens when they have grocery stores and condos move in. They put up the cameras too, right?
Well, they should have left the condos and grocery stores somewhere else.
Cohen says that's the kind of tension that fuels his books. In Brooklyn, some community is always being displaced by another.
There are so many different forces working on these neighborhoods. They're not static at all. And the points, the lines where things are changing create conflict and sometimes create violence.
Like in the first Jack Leitner mystery, a young Hispanic man's death is linked to a rich white developer. Or in the latest book called Neptune Avenue, it's a West Indian victim, a Hasidic suspect, and the Russian mob thrown in for good measure. No shortage of grudges in Brooklyn these days. To end our tour of Red Hook, Cohen brings me inland to see the final clue.
We are standing next to the Brooklyn Queens Expressway, which sort of runs in a kind of a ditch that cuts Red Hook off from the rest of Brooklyn.
Urban planner Robert Moses built this highway in the 1950s, and Red Hook was never the same. So, is Moses the culprit? Did Cohen figure out exactly who killed Red Hook? Like in any good mystery, there's a twist.
It's not dead. It's not dead yet.
That's what you've discovered. After this whole mystery story, it's not dead.
Absolutely not. You see a lot of weeds coming up out of the cracks of the Red Hook sidewalks, and the whole neighborhood is really like that. It's hopefully indestructible.
Which is exactly what draws Cohen and his detective back here for more. Robert Smith, NPR News, on the edge of Red Hook, Brooklyn.
I want people to understand the fundamentals of cooking. When we understand the fundamentals, we can do anything.
Michael Ruhlman has written or co-written 13 cookbooks, most of them recipe books, but he's now trying to wean home cooks away from recipes. He wants people like you and me to memorize simple ratios, basic number combinations like 3-1, or 3 parts meat, 1 part fat for sausage, or 3-2 for a soup stock, 3 parts water to 2 parts bones. Michael Ruhlman's new book is called Ratio. He joined me earlier this week at one of D.C.'s hottest restaurants, Proof. We sat down just as the lunch crowd thinned out.
What do you want people to learn from this book?
I want them to understand the interrelated nature of all the basic fundamentals that we use. How bread dough works. Bread dough is basically 5 parts flour, 3 parts water. You need a little yeast, you need a little salt, but people use different amounts of those. But you need to stick to the 5-3 flour to water ratio, and that's what gives you a bread dough.
Now you've written, or you sort of suggested in the book, that you want to free people from the shackles of recipes. What do you mean by that?
I think that people can get too dependent on recipes, that they believe that if they miss a step or if they have a tablespoon and a half rather than a tablespoon, that it's all going to go kerplooey. That's not true.
Michael, you've written cookbooks, co-written cookbooks. You've written other books about food. How did you come to decide to write a book about the ratios involved in cooking?
This book has been gestating for 10 years. When I was at the Culinary Institute of America writing a book called The Making of a Chef, I interviewed an old German chef named Uwe Hessner. He was the leader of the skills classes, all the fundamentals classes, and he sort of waved dismissively at a shelf bulging with cookbooks and said, "I can show you everything that is on this shelf in 2 pages. And I said, "This I'd like to see." And so he turned around, handed me a sheet of ratios that he'd made for his skills classes because he'd gotten tired of seeing his kids, his students, always having their head in books, always chained to their recipes. He said, "If you know the ratio and a basic technique, you don't need books."
All right. So now we're going to prepare 2 items this afternoon. What are we going to do?
We're going to do the quiche Lorraine, which requires 2 ratios, the custard ratio and the pie dough ratio.
Great. Let's head to the kitchen.
The kitchen staff is already chopping and roasting and prepping for the dinner rush. We've taken over a patch of real estate in the corner of the kitchen. On the cutting board, Ruhlman lays out the basic ingredients for cooking with the ratio method: butter, flour, milk, oil, cream, and eggs. And now we're ready to start the quiche. So we're making the pie dough right now.
We're making a basic pie dough, a basic 3-2-1 pie dough. It's 3 parts flour, 2 parts fat, 1 part water.
Well, what's the difference between a pie dough and, you know, pasta dough or bread dough, for example? I mean, how different are the ratios?
The ratios are fairly similar, actually. There's almost no difference between a pie dough and a biscuit dough, for instance. A biscuit dough is a pie dough, only the water and fat are reversed. When you understand ratios, you understand the interconnectedness of all our fundamental products in the kitchen.
When the pie dough is ready, Ruhlman rolls it out about a quarter-inch thickness. And here's the important part. You have to use a mold with really high sides, at least 2 inches. So you might want to invest in a cake pan.
No, it's important for people to realize that a proper quiche really needs depth so that you can appreciate the texture of a custard. Got a bad rap here in America because someone convinced us that we could make it in a pie plate.
I see.
And we're going to taste how good a quiche can be.
And by the way, we will have the recipe for your quiche Lorraine at our website, npr.org.
Excellent. Excellent.
The crust has to blind bake for about 15 minutes before you can add the custard and the filling. So it goes into a hot oven, and we move on to frying up some rough-cut slab bacon.
There's no better smell on earth, I think, than bacon cooking.
And then we start sautéing slivers of onion. And while those two ingredients cook up, we can use our ratios to make the custard.
For something to be called a custard, it has to have a few basic things.
It has to have a liquid, and it has to have an egg. If you take away the egg, or if you take away the liquid, you don't have a custard. So that's what these ratios try to do, to get down to the very essence of cooking.
And custard ratio is 1-2. 1 part egg to 2 parts liquid. In this case, a mixture of milk and cream. Measured carefully on the scale.
Bingo.
So what happens if you ignore the ratio here? If you add more milk or you add more...
Well, if you add too much, if you went overboard and weren't paying attention and added too much liquid, there's a chance that your custard wouldn't set up. If you added too little liquid, it might be too dense, too firm. What's great about a custard is the texture, that satiny, voluptuous texture.
The pie crust is now out of the oven and ready to be filled. So Ruhlman pours in half the custard, then he layers on half the onions and bacon and some grated Gruyere cheese. He repeats until the custard almost overflows the edge of the flaky crust. Then he pops it into the oven, 325 degrees, for about 90 minutes to 2 hours. Low and slow. It's worth the wait.
That looks absolutely delicious.
Why does it look delicious?
Because it has this golden crust and it has this...
Quivering, quaking. That's how you know it's a good quiche. It should quiver. It's just, it's the world's greatest pie, the quiche.
And though this was far and away the most delicious quiche I've ever eaten, it was pretty easy to make using 2 simple ratios. 3-2-1 for the crust and 1-2 for the custard. The other flavors? Well, that depends on your creativity. Michael Ruhlman's new book is Ratio, The Simple Codes Behind the Craft of Everyday Cooking. And special thanks to Chef Haider Karum and the staff of Proof here in Washington, D.C. for letting us take over part of their kitchen.
Once you can hear the pounding surf, once you've got the sunscreen on and you settle into the sand, it's time to really begin your vacation by cracking open a book. One of our editors, Ellen Silva, suggests that you find a book that takes you to the very place where you've chosen to vacate.
The beauty of reading books about beaches I'm visiting crystallized for me 3 summers ago. That's when I picked up Nathaniel Philbrick's Mayflower while sitting beside the bay in Truro, Massachusetts on Cape Cod. Philbrick's lush history of the Pilgrims gave me an entirely new perspective on the nooks and crannies of the fabled peninsula. Inspired by one story about the Pilgrims stealing a secret stash of Native American corn in 1620, I grabbed the book, hopped on a bike, and followed the tiny signs to Cornhill in Truro, where the event occurred. The hill was still there. The corn was still missing. That experience reminded me of other beach trips. At Venice Beach in California, I watched the skateboarders and bodybuilders at the beach there and read Light My Fire by Ray Manzarek. He's the co-founder and keyboardist for The Doors. Manzarek's memoir took me back to the Age of Aquarius days of the late 1960s. His prose captured the trippy carnival atmosphere of Southern California in those Dionysian times. The book made me feel like I might bump into a young Jim Morrison at any moment. In Florida's South Beach, writer Brian Antoni was my guide. Antoni is a popular party host who lives in the glitzy seaside city. He also restored one of the famous Art Deco properties that line the heart of the historic district. His book is simply titled South Beach. The operatically complicated plot of this romantic melodrama and larger-than-life characters allowed me to float like a voyeur through South Beach's antique decadence. Of course, none of these books really allow me to relive the history or fully enter the culture of these places. I'll never really know what it means to be a pilgrim or a Native American in Cape Cod in the 17th century or a California hippie in the 60s. But reading them allows me to take up residence in these briny outposts and let some of the sun and salt seep into my skin. When I returned to Cape Cod this summer, I unearthed a buried treasure of a book in the corner of a beach cottage just outside of Provincetown, Massachusetts. It was by Mary Heaton Vorse, a writer, labor activist, and foreign correspondent who moved to Provincetown in the early 1900s. Her memoir, Time and the Town, A Provincetown Chronicle, was written in 1942. The book is alive with stories and delicious anecdotes about the artists and writers who summered there. But it also depicts the daily life of the gutsy Portuguese fishermen and their families. Reading it gave me a whole new perspective on a town known today for its thriving gay community, whale watches, and beaches. And so during a recent day trip to Martha's Vineyard, I wished I'd brought along Yale Law Professor Stephen Carter's novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park, along for the ride. Much of the action of this intellectual thriller takes place in Oak Bluffs. I imagine President Obama whipping through it on his vineyard vacation later this summer. Reading books like these under an umbrella enriches the experience of both the book and the beach. They capture the local texture of some of our nation's most popular vacation spots and make visiting your favorite beach a deeper, more intimate experience.
Ellen Silva produces commentaries about books for All Things Considered. To find out how our audience voted on the best beach books ever, go to thenewnpr.org.